Thank you. Thanks, Kieran. It's great to give a talk at the KITP. I'm in the math department here at UCSB. It's the first time that I give a talk at the KITP. So this today I'll talk about this sublinear scaling or asymptotic-based sublinear scaling algorithms this is going to be for solids. And this is work that I've done jointly with Wayne and Yi at Princeton. Jianfeng Lu, who was a student at the time, but now he's currently a postdoc at an instructor at Grant. And also by Yulin Xuan, who was used to be here at UCSB, but now she's not here anymore. And this was supported by partly by an NSF Career Award. So I didn't know the background of the people, but so I thought there's some introductory slides that I will skip, or I will go over quickly, mostly just to introduce the notation that I'm going to be using. So so these kind of algorithms that we have developed are in the or can be we developed them in the context of both Thomas Fermi type models, like Thomas Fermi or Weizsäcker, things like that, or in the context of CONSHAM, which is a lot more difficult, a lot more interesting, but also technically a lot more difficult. So the Thomas Fermi was a good playground sort of for these kind of ideas. So I'll discuss what I mean by sublinear scaling algorithms, and then how to, again, I didn't know the background, so I'll try to motivate where all these principles, all these ideas that we're using come from simple problems on studying crystalline solids, and then describe exactly what it is that we're doing, and how we solve the CONSHAM problem with, or how do we apply this to the CONSHAM problem. Okay, and then I don't know if I'll have time to discuss this linear scaling methods that we have developed for CONSHAM. In this particular case, when we talk about sublinear scaling, I'll describe where the reduction in the degrees of freedom doesn't necessarily come from how we solve the DFT. So you can still use, in principle, any kind of DFT code that you have with some minor, there's some issues that have to be resolved, but essentially you can solve it any way you want to get the electronic density and then try to couple it with, use the same ideas to study a material, right? So, but if I have time, I'll describe this linear scaling algorithm. Okay, so the reason why we want to do this, of course, is because it's a first principles approach, and the problem that we have in mind is a defect in a solid. So this is a fracture that is propagating because it's breaking the chemical bonds. So we need to have sort of atomic resolution near the crack tip, but outside we assume that the material is smoothly deformed, elastically deformed. And of course, I'm going to use Born-Oppenheimer approximation. So we're going to treat the nuclei classically. I'm going to ignore the spin. You will only see it here and no more. And all relativistic effects we are avoiding. And this is all only for the equilibrium ground state density functional theory. So we start from the ground state here. I mean, this is just introductory. So this is a notation that we're going to be using for the density. We have the potential. We have the Coulomb term. This is the Thomas Fermi type of approach without the von Weizsäcker correction. And then, of course, the functional Hohenberg Kohn functional. So this is the functional that I'm going to be using for the Kohn sham. And here it's written assuming so with the orthogonality constraint. But I'll describe it later on with the non-orthogonality constraint, because when we look at a crystalline solid, we want to decouple somehow, or use, not have all the system coupled to everything else in the system. So we want to use non-orthogonal formulation, which I'll describe later on. And this is a bit of, this might not be the standard notation that people use. So here I'm including this M, which is some sort of, so this is the atomic, something that's going to describe the atomic background. So it's like if you put here a delta distribution, then it would give you something like the Coulomb repulsion. But here we have I have this, and this could be some corrections to this, or just a pseudo potential. Everything that I'm going to do works in the case of pseudo potentials, at least in the Kleiman-Bylander type of Trulia-Martin type of pseudo potential. I'm not sure for the ultra soft how this will exactly work.
Sorry.
Yes.
Again.
I'm sorry. Oh, the M. So this could be, for example, Gaussians that just represent. So I'm smearing the atoms. So I'm not using.
The nuclei?
Yeah, the nuclei. I'm smearing the nuclei. So I can use something to, for example, I can introduce something here in order to kill off the decay, the Gaussian decay on the pseudo potentials, for example, and then just have everything localized. Right? So if I want to strictly do linear scaling, I have to do that.
But why do you? Them, you mean they have a, they're not delta functions?
That's right, this mirrored. So I'm using just the, so here I'm using the valence electrons only.
No, but why are you mirroring the nuclei as opposed to having them as delta?
Well, because if, okay, so you can try to, if you want to use them as delta functions, you can correct that. But in principle, if you're going to use a pseudo-potential, you're already smearing somehow. Yeah. So you want to be consistent. Yes, yes. So this, so but this now is locally, is compactly supported. So you have killed off the decay that got like 1/r. So now everything is local. Both m is local, and the v is local. Yeah, so this is just, you can, if you want, I mean, when I look at the problem later on, you'll see that this part actually becomes. So I'm going to talk about a neutral defect, and then this part. I need, because I need, for the periodic problems, I'm going to need nuclear zero charge, net charge. So I need to have something there, right? But from the linear, from just, I mean, if you want to do something that is linear scaling, if you, just to construct the pseudo-potentials, you would have to have them somehow localized. Otherwise, you have to take into account all the interactions.
And so I'm confused. I mean, this is your total energy expression. So this expression which you're just discussing is the nucleus-nucleus interaction.
Yes.
Which you anyhow cut down by Ewald summation in the short range and long range term and evaluated.
Yes.
So I don't.
Yeah, this is that's how you actually evaluate it.
Right.
But I want to start with a clean problem that has no, right? This is separate from how you evaluate it. So I'll just leave it at that. And of course, the density in this case, because of the orthogonality constraint, they're defined like this. And then we're just going to use the, so what I'm going to talk about, I'm just going to use the LDA, although there's no limitation in using the GGA for the algorithms that I'll describe. But we did everything so far in the GGA, in the LDA case. OK, so then, of course, the Euler-Lagrange equation leads to the standard eigenvalue, a nonlinear eigenvalue problem, where these now are the Lagrange multipliers for these constraints. And then the, so the if we want to use this for a solid, where we then we have to deal with all the degrees of freedom, all the electrons, which is completely impractical. So the idea in the sublinear scaling is to reduce, or what we mean by that is algorithms whose complexity is sublinear with the number of electrons. Right? So we. That's why, so it doesn't scale like, so usually when we talk about, in electronic structure, when we talk about order n, means n is the number of electrons. Now we actually want to do something that is sublinear in that, not even order n. You have a question?
Yeah, it seems like it's, how could you go lower than linear? I mean, suppose
okay.
You had a DNA chain
yes.
And had, you know.
Yes, okay. So the classical example of a sublinear algorithm, for example, would be the Bloch theorem. You have a periodic crystal with infinitely many electrons.
That's not kind of the problem that you would want to solve, is it?
In this case, it is, because it's a crystalline solid that is elastically deformed.
But you only have to do one unit cell if you have blocks
here. That's right. Here, we don't do that. But what I mean is, that's just an illustration of that would be sort of the goal, the optimal reduction that you can get. But it is, you're dealing with an infinite number of electrons, but you just solve problems in a periodic cell. Right? So that's the kind of, what I mean is, when I talk about sublinear, the way we actually reduce the number of degrees of freedom is similar to that approach, right? Where the elastic deformation is smooth, you can somehow, using the asymptotics, using asymptotic analysis, you can reduce the, you can capture the leading term in the wave functions by solving periodic problems.
On the face of it, if you have sublinear scaling, then you could take two problems, combine them into one big problem with a lot of space in between, and solve them more quickly than you could.
No. Because you need to have the crystalline structure underneath.
He's talking about a specific type
right.
of problem.
You need to have the underlying crystalline structure. Otherwise, this approach doesn't work.
So you're saying the unit cell has to always be quite simple.
Not necessarily. No. Not
necessarily.
I mean, in some sense, yes, because you want to use asymptotics. But so if the unit cell breaks or becomes too non-smooth, the deformation, elastic deformation is non-smooth, then the asymptotics break down. Right. So near the defect, you have to do something purely atomistic. But far away, assuming that it's elastically deformed, then you can do asymptotics. That's the main idea. right? So this block theorem is sort of the extreme of what you can do with sublinear scaling algorithms. But a more sort of traditional approach in mechanics is the quasi-continuum method, right? Which was developed with empirical potentials by Tadmor, Ortiz, and Phillips, and then has been analyzed subsequently by Wen and Yi, Zhenfeng Lu, Jerry Yang, and Dobson and Luskin, and a number of other people. And this sort of ideas or similar ideas have been extended to the context of orbital-free DFT with Thomas Fermi von Weizsäcker type of functional, initially by, I guess, by Hayes, Ho, Ortiz, and Carter, and later, more recently, by Gavini, Bacciatari, and Ortiz. And then there's also the, so this is supposed to be an accented E, but somehow I'm not sure why it didn't come out like that. So this this approach, which is the non-perturbative embedding approach, which is a different sort of idea, fairly recent, by Eric Cancés, De Laurent, and Mathieu Levine. So the idea in the quasi-continuum method, and where this reduction in the number of degrees of freedom comes from, is that you have a defect somewhere here in your system. So you treat near the defect, near the crack, or whatever you want to study, you do this. You need to look at the system at the atomic scale. Right? So you have to do this in a level that is fully atomistic. Now, far away, assuming that you have smooth elastic deformation. Of course, in the plastic regime, you cannot do that. But in the elastic region, where the deformation is smooth, the idea here is to use the Cauchy-Bonne rule, which says that if you look at the deformation, at the local deformation here, then you assume that the atoms in your crystalline lattice are deformed by the same uniform deformation in the cell. Right? So then you have a deformation. So the way this was constructed or done for the quasi-continuum method was you lay down a finite element discretization, say piecewise linear. So then you look in an element that is in this region, because it's piecewise linear, your gradient, your deformation, the deformation gradient is constant. So then you have there a system that is, you can think of it as a periodic system, infinite periodic system, where you have that the whole crystalline lattice is deformed with the same deformation, uniform deformation. And then because it's periodic, you can compute all the properties of the system by just looking at one cell. Okay, so then this element here in the finite element discretization could contain thousands of crystalline units. Crystalline cells.
Are they saying in this region elasticity theory works?
Yes.
And that's it?
Yes, that's right. So that's how it was constructed. Right. Okay. So then in that case they do it with empirical potentials and so forth, but then they have to somehow couple this to the atomistic region. Okay, so of course in the context of quantum mechanics, this is what we're trying to, it turns out that something like this can also be done. And for that I just need to describe briefly the Floquet block theory. I'm not sure, usually in mathematics, not everybody is very well acquainted with this, so I wasn't sure what the audience was like here. But so we have the Hamiltonian like this, where this V is, this potential is periodic. So then the wave functions can be found to be of the form an exponential, complex exponential times a function that is periodic with the periodic periodicity of the lattice. So if we, just as an illustration, if I take a potential like this, and then I can compute it, and you can see that the block waves, so they sort of like, so they have a highly oscillatory component that is sort of slowly modulated, but the density is completely delocalized. Right? If we represent this in terms of one-year functions, right, then by constructing the one-year function for each different band, then we have a basis that is going to be translation invariant. So then the density, so the block wave which was completely delocalized, now in contrast, the one-year functions are completely localized in some cases. Although of course, for an insulator, this works very well for an insulator, but when you have a metallic system, not so much. Right? So the idea then is to try to incorporate these things. But the way usually the one-year functions are incorporated are used as basis functions. And we want to avoid using basis functions. We want to do everything in real space. And we want to generalize also the idea of one-year functions or somehow introduce this localization to systems where we don't have orthogonality. Right? So there's a number of work that has been done in this context. And I guess the closest that we sort of to what we do is the idea of maximally localized Bonnier functions introduced by Mazzari and Vanderbilt. But I'll describe, a different way, or the way that we do it, which is slightly different from that. So the idea then is to look at the, if we look at the system in a region where the deformation is smooth, then we can, so we write the equation, the Consham equations, and this epsilon here now is the small parameter, which is the lattice constant divided by the diameter of the domain. So usually the equations are written in atomic units, so there's a one in front of the Laplacian, but in this context, I would just change the variables to use the to make our unit is just the size of the lattice. Okay, so we get an equation like this, and then because this function, the size, look somehow like this, we expect to have sort of a highly oscillatory function modulated by some smooth function, which is the elastic deformation. Right? So in some sense, what we're doing is trying to think of these functions as the one-year function. So then we do a multiple scale expansion for this. So this would be similar to what is done in the context of homogenization, for those of you that are familiar with it, where you have, so here the we have a periodic structure, or a somewhat periodic structure, which is the deformed crystalline structure. Right, so, but because it's a slow variable at the scale of the interatomic lattice, this is somehow, this is almost periodic. And then we do this multiple scale expansion where we have a technical issue, and that's that when you look at the two problems, you have an elastic problem, elasticity problem, and you have a Consham problem, the electronic structure. So the elasticity problem is more naturally seen in Lagrangian coordinates. So we know where the unit cell is, and we deform it, and we know. So we keep track of the deformation, where we always know where the atoms were. Whereas in the electronic structure, you give me the location of the atoms, and then I compute the electronic structure, I compute the electronic density. So these two representations, I mean, we want to keep the two representations because one is more convenient for one problem, one for the other. Right? So when I write this here, y and x, so the y, you have to think of it as the Eulerian variable, so we can recover y from x by using this elastic deformation. Right? So here, what I'm doing is y of x is x plus
u of x.
Okay, so that's my elastic deformation. So when I do the asymptotics, I need to take this into account. Okay, and then you'll see where that comes from. Okay, so now when I plug in this ansatz, so I look at the multiple scale expansion here, and I look at wave functions that somehow decay when epsilon goes to zero. So I'm trying to recover, or in some sense, I'm assuming that I can do this expansion with somehow something that has the similar properties to the one-year functions. Then once I have this expansion for the wave functions, then the expansion for the density is given to me from this relation here. And then once I have this, I have a similar expansion for m, for the location of the atoms, and then I have a similar expansion for phi that comes from this equation. Right? So then when I plug this in here and I look at the leading term, what I get is this expression, which looks quite complicated, but what it says here is that I have to solve this problem here, which is the Consham problem, but only on a periodic cell, which is deformed by the local deformation. So I guess with the notation there, this shouldn't be u, this should be phi. This is phi of x. So then I have, sorry. This is u, and this is what is called there phi of x. Okay, so the gradient of phi is not singular. This should be u.
Excuse me, could I ask about the difference between an asymptotic expansion and a normal Taylor expansion?
Yes, sure. The asymptotic expansion, as you can see, doesn't have Taylor expansion. It's just in power. It's a polynomial in epsilon. Whereas the asymptotic expansion doesn't have to be. I could have. And the second thing is that the Taylor expansion will usually converge when you look at more terms, right? But this one will converge when epsilon goes to zero, which is different from using higher order terms.
So how do you get this?
Meaning. So, okay, so this, in principle, at this level, this is just an ansatz. This is just a guess. So from experience, we know that when you have, so if you do a function, if you look at an expansion of that has two different scales, one slowly variant scale and a highly oscillatory scale. Then there's a technique developed for many years, which is the multiple scale expansion. And well, you think of the highly oscillatory function or scale as part of the problem as well. So you see the problem as a problem with two variables, one that is going to be slowly variant, the other one that is going to be that's going to change rapidly, right? So because if you don't do that, then you have resonances, and you only get expansions that are valid for very short times or very short distances, right? Whereas if you assume that you have this kind of, if you introduce this new variable as part of the problem, then you get expansions that are more uniform for longer periods of time or longer distances. And then the actual shape of this thing comes from, so here in this context, for example, here, if I look at this thing here, I know, so my guess is that the leading term is going to be the Cauchy one, right? So it's going to be the periodic problem, right? So then I have that these functions have to be normalized to be total mass one, so this gives me this prefactor here. So when I look at one cell, if there's no deformation, if I look at just one cell, I expect to have something like this. My function actually is exactly this, is the Bloch theorem. So when I don't have that, then my guess is, well, I'm going to have some corrections to it, which in principle I don't know these exponents, but if I look at the expansion, I just put something arbitrary, then if I'm doing the expansion and the expansion is correct, that part, as per the expansion, I'm going to be recovering these exponents, right? But at the moment, at this level, there's no theorem. I mean, I cannot tell you for sure that this is true. I would have to explain or tell you I would have to prove a theorem to say, well, if I have the solution to this problem, then I have to prove that the actual solution minus this, when I take the limit as epsilon goes to zero, this goes to zero in some sense.
You can actually say in what sense.
Yeah, you would have to specify in what sense.
Well, yeah, but if you do an average over the small length scale,
mm-hmm.
then that's sort of moving, you know, over several unit cells, but not so many unit cells, but less than
sure.
Length scale,
okay.
Then
yeah.
You can show that it exactly goes
yeah.
to this.
Yeah.
Therefore,
that's right. So, otherwise, if the system becomes infinitely periodic, then you have to be able to add it up, right? I mean, so you still have to make sure that this thing is integrable
yeah.
and things like that. And so you have to give it in the right sense. But in some cases, one can actually prove it. And basically, what this amounts to, this part here, is to proving the thermodynamic limit for a system like this. So for example, that's what Levan-Simon did for Thomas Fermi. That's what Lebri, Lyons, and Kato did for Thomas Fermi von Weizsäcker, or they have done for the something like the reduced Hartree-Fock, which is the convex Hartree-Fock, and so forth. But this is essentially, this term recovers the same for the density. This term recovers exactly the thermodynamic limit. That's what gives you this. And so which somehow indicates that this is the right scaling. It's telling you that this is the right scaling. So when you look at this, sorry.
Many of them discussed it just now, but I didn't quite get the answer.
Uh-huh.
So if you had all electrons in the gate, including the core, does this actually not scale the core electrons, but scale the
valence curve? No. If you include the core electrons, you have the same thing. It's the same. I mean, you have the same expansion, the same limit. I mean, actually, the actual thermodynamic limit that was proved by Levan-Simon was with the core electrons. There was no smearing.
Because I'm confused about the epsilon and the plus.
Oh, this epsilon?
Yeah.
This comes because of the scaling of the energy. So if you look at the Coulomb energy, it has a certain scaling.
But there's an M in there. But the M is your homework.
Yes.
So why do you scale the
M? Well, M also scales the same way, because M has to give every unit cell, I have a fixed number of electrons and atoms. So M has to scale in the same way.
It's a fixed part of the scaling, right?
No. Of course, you have to scale it, because if you look at the,
Make it bigger. Unit cell doesn't mean you actually scale the core.
I'm not making bigger the unit cell. What I have is the unit cell, and I'm writing the density, or if you want, the atomic function determined in new variables. Right, so I know that this thing here is equal to the number of electrons in the cell. So if I rescale the variables, if this is the cell, and I'll write it so that the cell has size 1, then when I do the change of variables, what I get is this term. So that, I guess, This is, okay, so this is for the size one, the atomic scale, and then this is for the, yeah, so epsilon is the atomic, the size of the unit cell. So when I integrate in a unit cell, this will still be equal to n. Right? This is just like that. I mean, you can think of m as a density. If you look, it's not that I'm rescaling it arbitrarily, it's that if I change the variables, my function has to change accordingly so to make sure that I still have the same number of electrons in the system. I'm not introducing new electrons. That's all. It's a change of variables.
Okay, so your m of x divided by x is not a simple function.
What do you mean a simple function? It's like a Gaussian, for example.
It's no different from what it was before.
Yeah.
So are you saying it's all these funny dependencies, like 1 over epsilon to the 3 times 1 over epsilon
yes.
cubed, they all arise from the rescaling?
So the rescaling introduces the epsilon into the equations, right? Yeah. But if I want to look at the limit of the solutions, the leading order has to have total mass 1 in the wave functions, right? So the leading order, the scaling has to be given to me by that. Right? The scaling of m comes because the total number of electrons in a unit cell is fixed. So if I rescale my variables to look at the unit cell that has, instead of unit length 1, has unit length epsilon, then this function changes like that. I mean, it's the only way I can keep the same number of electrons inside.
Right. Let's go on.
Okay. So if you do the asymptotics, you get this, the leading order term, which is exactly the thermodynamic limit that for the Kontian problem on the unit on the cell that is deformed by the local deformation, okay? Because the local deformation is a slow variable. So then at that point in space, the atoms only see the local deformation, right? Which is stretched the variables. Okay, so this is exactly, so what this proves is that if you look at the asymptotics, you recover the Cauchy-Bond rule, right, from the equation directly, rather than impose it as something that is sort of intuition that we have. You actually do recover it from the equation. But moreover, because of the nature of the asymptotics, I can actually construct corrections to the Cauchy-Bond rule. And you can look at high-order equations that tell you if the Cauchy-Bond rule is not good enough for you, then you can still add another correction to the term. And then instead of just solving for the leading term, you can solve for this one as well, and this one as well, and so forth. So you can add corrections. So the model itself, your description of the crystal, is you can make it as accurate as you want by using higher-order asymptotics. Right? Of course, there's a limitation in the sense that you have to prove that this is the right expansion. Right? You have to prove a theorem that says that that's the right expansion, but nevertheless, in principle, you can do that. Okay. Yes.
So basically, what you have shown so far is that the density follows the same equation as in the crystal in the Lyapunov-Lensky.
Yes.
So locally, you can solve the problem as if this
yes.
would be reality.
That's right.
Now, what about the total number of electrons in this region?
Uh-huh.
In other words, how do we know that your electrons are uniformly distributed?
So that is an assumption of this asymptotics. I'm assuming that whenever I look at one problem at the cell, in the periodic cell, I always have the same number of electrons. That is a limitation.
Okay.
Right? This is an assumption that I'm making,
all right,
which is not clear. I would have to make sure that they get distributed accordingly.
Okay.
That's right. Okay, so then how do we do now? So we have a good way of doing solving the Kontian problem, getting the Kontian, so the electronic density in the region where there's no defect by the asymptotic. So we already have, this gives us the reduction in the number of degrees of freedom. Right, just like the Bloch theorem. So now we look at the part where we have the defect. Right? So here we need to do the fully atomistic problem. But we have to do it in a way that is consistent with what we have done outside. Okay. So in order to do that, we start by looking first at a non-orthogonal formulation of Kontian. Because if we do impose orthogonality, then we have to orthogonalize this to everything else. And not only that, whenever we solve this problem, we need to make sure that those wave functions are orthogonal to everything else in the system. So we want to avoid that. So that's the first thing, is to look at a non-orthogonal formulation. Then we need to make sure that these atoms here, this system, is, or this subsystem, actually feels the environment from outside. The fact that this is embedded, it's not just an isolated system in vacuum, but it's embedded within something else. And then in order to be able to do that without having to couple at infinitely long length scales, we have to use localization. Right, which is actually going to determine what the environment is. So the non-orthogonal formulation of Kontian is given in terms of this overlap matrix, So we have the, which is just the metric of inner products. So the formulation is exactly the same. So this, I'm sorry for the change in notation. This actually represents the pseudo potential that I had before, because anyway, for reasons that I don't need to get into. But it's the density. So the only change is in the way you compute the kinetic energy, the way you compute the density. Right? But this is a big change because S couples the whole system. So we have to figure out, make sure that when we compute this S, we can localize the temper. Okay, so now we look at the Northman formulation. We define the environment here to be essentially the region around the non-smooth region where the formation is plastic. And then we'll see, so let's see how we do that. Oh, I think I went back. So the advantage of using this formulation now is that the wave functions are not orthogonal, but also the energy functional now is only depends on the space that is spanned by these wave functions, right? So before the classical Kohn-Sham is orthogonal, is invariant in orthogonal transformations. This one is orthogonal, is invariant under any kind of transformation that is one-to-one. So this will help us here. Doesn't matter so much, but it will help us in developing this linear scaling algorithms if I get the chance to talk about. And here, so now the emphasis is precisely in the subspace spanned by these. Right? So this algorithm that I will talk about is precisely a subspace iteration type of algorithm. And then it turns out that the non-orthogonal wave functions have better localization properties than the orthogonal ones. So this is something that works also to our advantage when we try to do this. So how do we embed this sort of system, finite system, within the perfect crystal? So to do that, we separate the wave functions into three regions. If you think of this in terms of the QMMM approach, where you want to use quantum mechanics and molecular mechanics in some different region, you basically have a domain decomposition and you truncate bonds here and there and then just try to couple the two systems. Here we don't actually do that. Right? So what we do is we separate the wave functions that correspond to atoms that are within our fully atomistic region and the atoms that are outside, which we can correspond to atoms in where the deformation is smooth. Hard to say, but that's what we do. Where the asymptotics are correct. So the asymptotics are a good description. Right? So we have we deal with all the wave functions. We just deal with them, depending on where they are, we deal with them differently. So we look at, we only look at the wave functions that are in the non-smooth region, and then we minimize the energy with all the other wave functions fixed. So that way the system feels the environment. So if you did this, then you would get exactly if you do this, you can think of this as a two-step minimization, where you minimize first with respect to the outside wave functions, a bunch of wave functions, and then you minimize with respect to the rest. And if you do the minimization, and you iterate between the two steps, then you end up with the actual minimum. And so that's what we do. So in order to couple the two systems, what we do is we use this, a subset of the indices in the smooth region. We call it environment. So now we have, maybe picture here, we have these wave functions that we are going to be localized that corresponds to the region where the deformation is not smooth, right? And then I have another set of wave functions that I have already pre-computed. And of course, they're going to overlap, right? Because the wave functions extend beyond the region that we want to compute. So we look at that environment that contains the regions that the wave functions that we have already pre-computed, and that are only the ones that overlap with these ones. Okay, so we just look at a small region around our domain of interest, and those are the ones that are going to help us define the density inside, taking into account what the environment is. Right? Because of localization, these wave functions only see the ones nearby. They don't see the whole system. Okay. So when we compute the density, if you split the density into these sets of indices, you get four terms, or the one is repeated. Right? So you get a four here. But if you look at the density only in the non-smooth region, then this term and this term, they're both zero. Because these are corresponds to wave functions that are too far away. So these terms correspond to wave functions that are here. And they don't overlap with the way I draw it. That's the wave functions here that do not overlap with these ones, the ones that I want to compute. So then these products are zero. So in the end, the only thing that I have in the non-smooth region, which is the region that is the support of the non-smooth, the functions, these wave functions that I have separated, right, that region, only functions, wave functions that are in the environment and in the and themselves interact. They don't see the rest, right? So the first, so this at the moment, this is an exact thing, assuming that these are compactly supported. This is exact, right? But now we have to approximate this S inverse. So now what we do is we actually replace this S inverse, which is the overlap matrix of the whole system. We replace it with the overlap matrix of only these wave functions. Right? So if the system is, I mean, because the deformation is smooth outside, one can actually prove that this what we truncate is exponentially small in this region. So we don't make a big, one can actually control the errors that we make when we truncate this overlap matrix. So now the strategy then is to, we lay down this coarse grid. So outside, because the deformation is smooth, the size of our discretization depends only on how smooth the deformation is. So this is standard numerical analysis. So we get a coarse grid outside and a fine sort of atomic scale grid inside. And then at here, where we compute, when we look at this point, this grid cell here, for example, I look at this grid cell and I know the deformation that I have at that point. Right? So I mean, inside I have a fully atomic description. Outside I have a description in terms of the deformation. Right? So at that point, I know what the deformation is at that point. So then I can use the Cauchy-Bond rule to deform my unit cell accordingly, and then compute the density in that cell. In that, at this point, right, which will represent, of course, the density of many cells, right? But this, I can compute that, I can do everything outside, and then once I have outside, I can just do that as an environment for the problem inside, and then I can solve the problem inside. So then, if I want to compute the forces, now that's, I have to, I mean, of course, there's, I mean, that's another layer of complication, right? But at the moment, for the electronic structure, there's another term that, so there are two, essentially two ways of coupling this region with the outside. One is this one that I mentioned here, because it's in the nature of quantum or quantum mechanics that the wave functions are not, I mean, extend beyond the region that you want to compute. And the second one is that now you have all the wave functions outside, the smooth region, and that is creating a Coulomb, I mean, there's a coupling because of the Coulomb term, which is a long-range interaction. Right? So the Coulomb term, you can see the outside as just a background potential. So you can compute the Coulomb interactions of all these in this region and leave it fixed as a background potential. And so if you decompose the Coulomb term into all the different contributions, you have a contribution of the non-smooth region, contribution of the smooth region, which contributes to Cauchy-Born, and then the coupling between the two. Yes?
You probably explained this before, but how do you know the deformation is uniform?
You don't. No. The deformation, I'm not saying that the deformation is uniform. What I'm saying is that when you look at the asymptotics, right? So the deformation is smooth function, is changing everywhere. Right? So the deformation at this point is different from here, there, right? But when I look at the at one point and I do the asymptotic expansion, the deformation is a slow variable, it's a smooth function. So it is as if I'm stretching basically. If I look at, I do a zoom of the deformation and I see my atomic structure then becomes order one, my deformation has basically in the limit. But this is the intuition behind the asymptotics, that the deformation has become constant, right? So, but this is a byproduct of the asymptotics, right? So the leading term in the asymptotics is the problem with the deformation that is fixed, right? But if I change the problem, then I have a different deformation, right? And if I wanted to do, instead of piecewise linear, I have piecewise quadratic finite elements, for example, then inside each element, at each different point in my element, I will have a different deformation. Inside the element, the deformation is no longer uniform.
So the deformation could also say you have a metric, linear.
Yes, yeah. That would be one way to look at it. So, okay. So then we need to. Okay. So then, yeah. So this is what I was telling before, that the coupling between the smooth and non-smooth regions come from this long-range interaction and the coupling through the environment, which is a way to ensure that the density is continuous. Then these long-range interactions we can compute with a number of ways that by now I'm somehow standard, like fast multiple methods or tree codes and things like that, or just by potential theory. which means solving Poisson's equation. And then we can, once we have this, then we can change the deformation by doing energy minimization outside. And the same thing for the location of the atoms. If you want to do mechanics, if you want to do dynamics, then you would have to do molecular dynamics inside, and then outside you have to do the linear elasticity, time-dependent linear elasticity. So then, I don't know if I have enough time to get into the details of linear scaling. I can try to get some of the details, and so just discuss briefly what one can do for the this linear scaling algorithm. So there's a number, of course, the history of this is quite by now is quite long, and there are many different approaches. So there's this orbital minimization, density matrix minimization, Fermi operator expansion, divide and conquer, etc. And there's a very, so our algorithm is based or somehow connected mostly, more than these approaches, with this suspense iteration introduced by Zhou, Sat, Tiago, and Angelikovsky in 2006, which is somehow the basis of the, I guess, the latest version of Parsec. The algorithm, we do also suspense iteration, but in the suspense iteration, they have to do orthogonalization, which is order n cube, right? But what we do is we replace that orthogonalization by a localization step. In essence, the orthogonalization makes sure that in the suspense iteration, your iteration doesn't your space doesn't collapse into a one-dimensional space. So you orthogonalize, you stay within an n-dimensional space. But we can do that with localization, which is actually an order n procedure. So then we achieve globally order n. Right? So the so this is the way we do this is first. I mean, we have this idea. That, I mean, the idea that is by now well known is that we don't care so much about the wave functions. We care just about the space that is generated by those wave functions. And then we just want to reproduce the space, so the subspace iteration is attractive in that sense. And then to make everything order n, we use localization. And then to make everything more efficient, we use filtering to filter out information, the unoccupied spaces, right? So, and we can do this with a real space formulation. We don't need to use diagonalization or basis sets or plane waves or anything like that, right? So, For localization, what we do is an extension of what Massari and Vandeveld did. You look at the wave, the space here generated by these wave functions. So given any set of wave functions, this is a linear algebra problem now, is to find a base for the same space, a basis for the same space that is actually localized. Right? So you can do that by minimizing somehow this an energy like this. And in some sense, it generalizes this idea of one-year functions. And you can, depending on the kind of weight that you put here, you can localize them more or less. Right? So the Marzari Vandeveld, the wave function was of this. So the weight was of this form with p equal to 1, to give you the standard deviation, right? Or the variance of the wave function. But you can do. You can essentially put anything, and the more you look, the higher the exponent you put, the more localized these wave functions become. If you can prove that you get extra localization. The problem is that numerically, for high p, this becomes unstable. So you have to reach a compromise, and our compromise is p equal to 3. So we get good localization properties and still a numerical problem that can be handled easily. So the way we localize the wave functions is you have them centered at certain locations, and then what you do is you look at one location, and then you look at all the wave functions that overlap with this, the wave function center there, and then you localize that wave function with respect to those. Okay, so then you get a wave function that is localized, and because the localization is happening at different locations in space, you end up with a system that has the same dimension as the one you originally had. Right? And of course, this can be a problem if the atoms get very, very close together. Right? But for the kind of systems that we have been looking at, this is okay. And then the beauty of this is that because everything is localized, you only have to do this, look at interactions with a fixed number of wave functions that depends only on the geometry, right? So this is order, you can do this with order n. You only need the smallest eigenvalue here, generalized eigenvalue, which you can compute in order n. And then what we do is for the subspace iteration is basically you have, so if you look at the idea of computing one, the largest eigenvalue is just the power method, traditional power method. And the convergence depends on the ratio of the highest eigenvalue to the smallest one, to the next eigenvalue, right? And you can recover the highest eigenvalue and the corresponding eigenfunction. So the suspense iteration is a generalization of that. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with this numerical algorithm, but there's a generalization of that where you want to do this for not just for one wave function, but for several of them. Right? So the standard, the classic suspense iteration developed, or at least described in Parlett's book, you start with a given set of wave functions, you apply the Hamiltonian, then you orthogonalize the space, and then you keep the orthogonal basis. So this step is of order n cubed, and then you repeat until convergence, and this, the rate of convergence depends on basically where you cut off in the spectrum, the next eigenvalue compared to the previous one. So you can improve the convergence by using a filter that will separate. So assuming that the filter separates the two sides of the spectrum, then your rate of convergence is going to be p of that divided by p of that, where p is the polynomial filter. Right? So if you use a filter that highly separates the two scales, then this number becomes much smaller than one. So the convergence improves. Right? But you can do this without actually diagonalizing. Surprisingly, you don't actually need the eigenvalues to do this. Right? So the idea is to apply a Chebyshev polynomial. This is as far as I know, I mean, it's a classical idea in numerical analysis, but in the context of electronic structure, it was introduced for the first time by Saad and Chelyakovsky. So the idea is that you have the Hamiltonian. If you look at in terms of the spectrum, you have the spectrum of the discrete Hamiltonian here. So you want to put this part of the spectrum, which is the unoccupied part of the spectrum, into this interval, and then you leave out the rest, because the Chebyshev polynomial will leave this part here essentially unchanged in magnitude. It's just a cosine, it's a polynomial function, but outside is a hyperbolic cosine, so it grows very fast. So here, this is -8, and this scale here is already 10 to the 11. So it's going to amplify this very effectively while leaving the unoccupied space almost unchanged. And effectively what you're doing is just filtering all this blue part out, which is what you don't want. Right? So that way you can compute the smallest part of the spectrum very effectively. Okay, so then what we do is we do this surface iteration, but we instead of orthogonalize, we do the localization step, and then we estimate the Fermi energy, but just we don't actually have to do the loading transformation, but you can use that to do, basically you end up having to do a power method for this matrix here, which is sparse and is very well behaved, so this can be done also in order n. I'll skip these details. Then we compute the density, but we have to compute this inverse, which we don't compute, but we actually do this type of Newton-Schultz iteration. Because so in certain cases, you can prove that this S, both S and S inverse are actually exponentially localized. This can be proved analytically. And then in those cases, this algorithm, you can do the convergence in order n. You can also do the pseudo-inverse approach of Weitao and Young, which is very similar. Okay, so I'll skip this part, and then I'll just leave this. So I had some examples, but essentially, so this sublinear, so we've developed the sublinear scaling algorithm. This is the case of Thomas Fermi, von Weizsäcker, where we have a system. We can study a system, for example, with a vacancy, and then this black region here just indicates where the non-smooth region is and where the smooth region is. And if you look at the density, you can see that this outside this region is where the vacancy, there's no vacancies, right? But you can see that there's no sort of problems at the interfaces between the two regions. We're treating the two regions differently, and there's really no problem at the interfaces. I think I'll stop here, because I went over the time that I had. And I'll answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Carl. Sure. You can always go back into the talk.
Okay, sure. And I'm at the math department, so
right.
It's a short walk from here.
So, discuss.
No pressure.
You construct not orthogonal basis.
Yes. No.
But you're using this optimalization criteria.
Yes.
Which does not give you a very robust competence, right? You still have exponential tail.
Yes.
How does that compare with LTO?
With
LMTO, linearized Bartikin orbital.
Oh. Well, the advantage of what we do is that we don't actually use a basis. We use finite differences. We use the we actually construct the wave functions with finite differences, and we just localize that. So we are not actually implementing a We don't use any basis sets or pre-compute any basis sets. So I guess that's probably the advantage. So we can, in principle, we can use any precision that we get. Right? We can increase the precision by refining or something like that.
Do you have an example where you have an exact solution and you apply to a procedure and see how well it matches?
We have examples of that in 1D, which I don't have here. We did this in the, that's not published, but we did that in 1D, but the closest that we have is this, which is actually a three-dimensional problem, a 3D computation. So we still, we're trying to do the analysis of these algorithms, right? Trying to understand the convergence. For example, here, trying to understand how big the non-smooth region has to be so that when we truncate S, we can control, we have good control of the errors and things like that. These are all issues, open issues that had to be understood. But we're trying to do that.
So outside of the non-smooth region, you have many different regions of different distortions.
Yes.
And how are these domains actually found, or how do you classify?
You don't classify. Okay. So no. So what you do is that. So one way to think about it is that we have finite difference, right? And then, imagine that you have the elasticity problem and you want to do, for example, divergence of the stress equal to the force, right? And you want to compute the stress. Now you don't have the stress, you don't have, constitutive law, right? So what I want to do, imagine that I have a grid, and then I say, well, so I'm going to approximate this by finite differences, so I want the stress here, so I'm going to do this by involving these values and doing finite differences. So and so forth, right? I do the standard finite differences. I discretize this with finite differences. So now what I would have to do is to compute the stress at this point. I need the stress at that point. Right? So when I look at that point, I say, well, I want to compute the stress. Now, so what the way I compute this stress is by solving sort of, so now I go aside and I use another computer and I solve this problem with the local deformation, because I know that the stress is going to depend on my deformation.
Yes.
So I have the deformation given to me because that information I have. So I look at this point and I deform the cell and I compute the stress from this Konsham computation, or orbit of free, quantum mechanics, whatever.
We don't use elastic constants.
Because it's not as accurate. Then you have to, that's what you would do in EAM, but then you have to, it's not a first principles type of approach. And then the problem's coupling with the quantum mechanics inside. That's.
You mean this is not linear elasticity? I don't know.
It's not linear elasticity, no. This is Konsham elasticity, I guess. Right. So here, one could do that. I mean, I could, for example, pre-compute all these things and keep a function of gradient of u. I mean, we have done that, actually. You can parameterize the function in six dimensions, but you can parameterize it, or actually pre-compute it, right? But so you go here, you compute with this local deformation. You go here, you compute with this local deformation. Of course, this is too extreme, right? Because the deformation is smooth. So this, the deformation here is not so different from the one there. So it would be slightly different. But I compute it here and there, and then I plug it in here, and I can solve this equation. So that's how you. It's not that I have to somehow identify all the different domains.
Calculations always when you solve your system, you have to compute at each point. You have to make such a small calculation.
That's right. That's what we do in the smooth region. So we pre-compute that part first. We do that computation, and we use that to solve. So we solve the elastic. That will give us. We needed to compute the density, which will give us the forces. But we also needed to compute the stress, and we needed to compute the Konsham problem inside when we look at the non-smooth region. But this is exactly what we do. Right? So in principle, you can do this on the fly, or you can do it by pre-computing this and say, leave this as a function. So I give you a symmetric tensor, positive definite symmetric tensor, and then you can pre-compute these things here. Then this you have to make sure that when you couple, if you do it like that, when you couple, you don't introduce something like ghost forces at the interfaces and things like that. But I could pre-compute this using quantum mechanics, using Konsham.
Well, that would be much more expensive overall.
Not much more expensive, I think. Well, you mean because of the six dimensions that I have to... Yes, but we... That's right, that's right. So the... So this is the pros and cons of pre-computing versus on the fly, right? So if you can do this efficiently, and by that I mean, so this is a function of six dimensions. So we did this in one context where we can, this is a function of six dimensions, so a uniform grid is too expensive, but you can use something called sparse grids, where you basically, the complexity of storing a function of in six dimensions is this, almost the same as one in two dimensions. And then you still recover the same sort of type of accuracy. And it's actually an interesting, so you can do it in a way that you basically have multiple grids, you're organizing multiple grids, and you can parallelize all the computation. So this can be done. I mean, we've done it in some small problems. And in fluids, for example, also with polymer fluids and things like that, where the stress depends on the rate of strain. And we can parameterize that from molecular dynamics. So at each point, the stress would come from a molecular dynamics simulation. And then the stress we actually pre-computed by averaging in time and things like that. But this is all pre-computed. You only have to do it once for one material. That's the advantage.
Let me get back to the issue of the compactness. For metallic system, you can still have exponential decay in your solution. Is it because you have a non-orthogonal condition?
No. For metallic systems, you wouldn't expect exponential decay of the one-year functions. You would only expect some algebraic decay.
But if you don't require them to be orthogonal, you should be able to.
Not necessarily. No, I don't think so.
But if you have algebraic decay, would this method still be?
No, this method has other more fundamental limitations in the case of metals. And that's, for example, it doesn't take into account fractional occupancies, for example. I don't think you would be able to capture that part with this method. Mm-hmm. So there's some limitations in that case. And if you look at a metal, I guess you would have to do something like the Fermi type of, you would have to compute the Fermi function of the Hamiltonian to be, I guess, true to the system.
So you'll be choosing still exponential decay
here.
You think that with a partial attribute, you'll be dealing with explicit density matrix, or
for this? No. In this case, I wouldn't use this for a metal.
Okay.
That's the short. I guess that's the short answer. I would only use it for an insulator.
So have you seen this approach before?
No.
Anywhere?
The one that we developed?
Yeah.
No.
The reason I mention it is because a long time ago, there was a development by Ken Wilson. He was trying to get a renormalization treatment.
Oh.
And what he did was something similar, sort of window quantum effect. You do something for large scale, but then you do a many body treatment in some small region.
Uh-huh. Now the many-body problem is done with the many-body Hamiltonian.
The inside.
Okay.
So it's
if you could. Okay. So
region you can have some hope of solving.
Sure.
And then you match. But it was sort of
if you could give me the reference, I'd love to see it.
Yeah.
If you remember and.
He may not have even published tonight.
Oh, okay.
But it was.
I mean, one here, for example. I mean, that approach, I mean, you couldn't use the many-body Hamiltonian, for example, because there's no thermodynamic limit for it. For the many-body Hamiltonian, I would need a thermodynamic limit to be able to do the unit cell. But there's no, that is not known. I cannot solve an infinite, a crystal with the many-body function, I mean, many-body Hamiltonian. Well, then it's a finite system.
No, it's coupled to the rest.
Yes, but the way, but in order to solve the many-body Hamiltonian, I cannot do that with a crystal. There's just no, I mean, when you start to increase, I mean, there's no limit, right? There's no thermodynamic limit in that case. So I couldn't use I don't have a periodic system to that I can plug in and solve it. So, I mean, I would be very interested to see this, how they couple it and match it. But,
you couple your scheme to any off-the-shelf AP code?
That's what I was mentioning before, that in principle you don't have to use this linear scaling algorithm. So outside, when you solve on the smooth region, there's no problem with that, because there's the two ingredients that you need is you need to compute the electronic density, because that's where you're going to need to compute the forces, and you need to compute the it has to be somehow localized so you can compute one-year functions. Right. So if you can do that.
Why do you need localization for this overlap region?
For the overlap region, yeah. So in the overlap region, one strategy would have to be to look at the environment region and then orthogonalize this whole system, but only the environment, right? And then I want to use localization to make sure that this doesn't affect the behavior outside and things like that. But when we designed this, we designed it with the linear scaling algorithm in mind. So. But it was later on that we realized that perhaps there's a way to just use standard, more standard algorithms to do this. But you have, I mean, there's some things that one has to be careful about, but I think it should be possible to do.
So other times with standard packages, you can use cells with an effect quite easily.
Right.
You wonder how much elasticity
So, yeah, okay. So that.
A way to estimate that.
Yeah. Right.
You do have one.
Well,
this is it. Right. About the
company.
Yeah.
I mean, presumably one approach is not your method, would be to say, solve a fairly large central region of quantum mechanically and embed it rather crudely to classical elasticity theory without worrying about what the wave functions are doing at the boundary and so on.
Uh-huh.
So presumably the advantage of your method is that you
would
need a much smaller central region.
Okay, so if you do what you said, I think you have to be very careful, because what can happen, and this was one of the problems with the original quasi-continuum, is that if you get a system where there's no deformation, where in principle the forces should be zero, it turns out that in the original quasi-continuum there were ghost forces in the interface. So the forces don't cancel out. So when you couple quantum mechanics with the molecular mechanics, we'd have to be very careful about that, make sure that that doesn't happen. I'm not sure, I mean, I can tell you right now how one would have to couple it, right? Because you have these two terms. You have the long-range Coulomb interaction that, so, I mean, what you said is, would be essentially, I mean, if I understand correctly, would be, so I look at the problem outside, and instead of computing this on the fly, I just compute the stress as a function of the deformation, and I store that. So now when I look at the problem outside, I can solve my elasticity problem. This would be essentially, if I do this with a system that has no plasticity, this is nonlinear elasticity at the level of quantum mechanics. So this would be, I guess, the closest one would get to solving the many-body problem for quantum mechanics, you know, for elasticity, right? So I could do that, but then when I have the defect, then I have to couple this kind of approach with the quantum mechanics inside. And that, I'm not quite sure how to do. But if there are no defects, if everything is smooth, I can pre-compute all this. You can pre-compute it with Kohn-Sham. And then you have, instead of using an empirical potential, like EAM or something, you use quantum mechanics to do an elasticity problem.
Okay, since the graduate students left the main
Oh, thanks. I'm sorry that went a little bit over time. I'm not sure if this is